from Local 12 Sports. It's the Skinny Podcast. Now, here's Richard Skinner.
Welcome into the Skinny Podcast. It's the weekly potpourri edition. I'm Richard Skinner, Local12.com digital sports columnist and editor with Rick Broering. Each and every week, we talk about sports topics of local interest, maybe a national topic or two, and then the portion of the podcast where you can ask me a question on any topic. Go to the Xverse, hit it up there on the hashtag AskSkinnyAnything. As always, this is brought to you by Blake, the attorney, Maislin. It is my favorite week of the year, Rick. Do you know why, Rick? It's my favorite week of the year.
The Masters?
Thank you, Rick. Indeed. Thought maybe you'd forget about that.
Shout out to me for even knowing that it was Masters week, but also that's your favorite week of the year.
Realize
that.
Oh yeah. And having gone last year has even deepened my love for the event. I will tell you, I took a week of vacation this week, not because of the Masters. It just kind of fell with a week I could take. The Bengals start ramping up some things next week where we get some locker room availability. So I thought, I got some vacation tomorrow. I'll do this week. But usually I'm trying to work on a Thursday, Friday, work around having like my TV up watching one thing. I got my computer on like Amen Corner or holes 15 and 16. And I literally veg out for Thursday and Friday as much as I can. And this week I get to do it while on vacation.
Now, do you wake up crazy early to do that? Don't they start real early in the morning?
I wake up early. I wake up at like 6:30 in the morning anyway, most mornings. So it's pretty easy to do. Yeah, but I'll watch the ceremonial first tee shot with the old goats out there. I think that's pretty cool that they do it. I don't know. And again, like having gone there last year, I remember Dan Horde told me, he said, it will exceed your expectations. I go, there's no chance. And it did. So there I am.
Wow. Better you than me. That's all I can say. I have a couple of friends that are going this year as well. And I said the same thing to them. Yep.
You know what days are going for?
Practice round.
Oh, cool. Yep. That's still pretty cool. Yeah.
Yep. But we've got a lot of actual news to get here too, in addition to the Masters, which I don't know that we'll actually talk about on this podcast. Sorry, Skinny.
That's okay.
College basketball news really dominated the week, obviously. And it started on Sunday night when news broke that John Calipari in Arkansas had agreed to terms on a 5-year deal. Now, there is some weird stuff that went on over the next 2 days, but ultimately, the deal was confirmed on Wednesday, and Cal will be introduced later this week. Kentucky is now searching for a new head coach for the first time since John Calipari took that job. So, Skinny, what's the part of all of this that stands out to you most? I mean, we're a few days removed from this. Everyone's gotten their hot takes out now. When you look back at what just played out over the last 4 days, what really stands out to you?
A couple of things, actually. One, I truly believe the reporting that he tried to leverage this job to get some other things at Kentucky, getting his son potentially hired, maybe some NIL things, some facility things. I truly believe that because it was a weird 48-hour period there, dude, for sure. He had not told Kentucky he was leaving. He had not told Kentucky that he was in talks. He did not quickly. I mean, that thing was reported on Sunday, and it seemed only natural he was going to sign his contract on Monday, Tuesday at the latest. Well, Tuesday started to evolve a little bit. And then I truly think that he thought he was going to be able to pull this off and leverage this and come back and coach. And just in the reaction from him and even his wife, Ellen's video, it didn't seem like they were overly enthused about going to Fayetteville, Arkansas. And the other part to it is, I think that he didn't. I think neither one of them understood how much the fan base has completely flipped on him here in the last whatever month, year, whatever your time frame is. I think he was completely oblivious to just how much the fan base had flipped on him. And once they figured that out, it was, okay, where's my get out of jail free card? Because he's taking less money at Arkansas. I mean, he kind of had Kentucky still over a barrel and chose to say, ooh, boy, this is worse than I thought. I'm getting out.
Yeah, I would agree with you that the tone of those videos were almost sad and almost like they had come to the realization that they're really not wanted at Kentucky and no one was going to come to fight or come to their defense. And Mitch Barnhart wasn't going to try to make that work and do more to make him stay. Like, I think Cal really thought after those meetings happened and after he and Mitch Barnhart put out that video and it was announced that he was staying, that he had all the leverage once again and that Mitch Barnhart was dying to have him back. It would really be screwed if he left. I think Mitch Barnhart was dying for Cal to leave, but just didn't feel like he could make it work if he fired him and had to pay the buyout. So in this case, I think Kentucky really got what it wanted. Looking back, I'm not so sure that John Calipari and his family did, although I will say I have a friend who is who used to work in the UK athletic department and still pretty connected to a couple key people there. And again, he doesn't get like inside information on the basketball team or recruiting or anything. But when something big like this is going on, he does get some information. And he started texting me on Sunday and he told me two things that I thought were pretty interesting. One, he said that the administration, as these rumors were starting and it was growing on social media, he said the administration had reached out to Cal to see if he would be interested in putting out a comment to sort of deny the claims that he was interested in the Arkansas job or to calm them down. And all he replied with was SMH, shake my head. Gave them no answer about whether it was real or not, just said shake my head, which clearly was not a denial. And that's when I think to the administration and the people at UK, things became real, at least according to my source. And the other thing that they told me was that Ellen, John's wife, was really uncomfortable with the idea of coming back because of how toxic the relationship with the fan base had become. So I don't know if it's true that they really went back and asked for more and they wanted to stay at Kentucky, or if in her mind and the family's mind, maybe it was already time to leave. But I will say that once Cal finally made the video and announced that he was leaving Kentucky, I thought he said the right things. He pointed out 100%. That it's time for a new voice. It's time for you guys to hear someone else's voice. And that's really where I think all of this is at. I don't think it's that John Calipari can't coach. I don't think it's that he can't recruit. And I don't think if I'm an Arkansas fan that I would be discouraged about the way things ended at Kentucky. I think I would still be really excited to get John Calipari as my head coach because I would be thinking that I'm probably going to get a better version of John Calipari than what he's been over the last few years. But all of that being said, I still think that Kentucky got exactly what they wanted out of this. And it's a little bit questionable as to whether Cal did or not. But I don't think there was any way that he really could have come back.
Yeah, I don't know who helped him take the temperature of the room in that time period where he did his radio show, sounded extraordinarily defiant, coming back to the meeting that really yielded no results with Mitch Barnhart, to that awkward video. It was almost as if he had determined, I'll make this work. And then whatever took place in the time frame from that to, you know, the rumblings in Arkansas, somebody got to him to tell him, dude, they don't want you back here. And I don't know who that was.
Here's what I want to know. How much did Cal know, or was he thinking about this? And when I say this, I mean the possibility of going to Arkansas, or maybe just the idea that he was still looking for a way out of Kentucky as soon as it was available to him when he made that video 2 weeks ago with Mitch Barnhart and when they had that meeting and then they announced that he was coming back. Because that video now, when you look back at it, and obviously everyone's gone through it and they've sent out screenshots of sort of Cal making a funny face or Mitch Barnhart making a funny face going like, you know, what did they know in this moment? But it is interesting to think about if Cal sat there with him that whole time and let Mitch kind of really stick his neck out there for Cal and say, yeah, we're going to bring him back. Oh, the whole time, if he knew that he was still thinking about taking that Arkansas job or looking for a way out, that's kind of crazy to think about.
Well, but I don't think Arkansas was open at that moment, was it? The chain of events, I think, occurred after that
I think there was already the rumblings about Muss and the situation at Arkansas and that he might have looked for other jobs.
Had Andy Enfield taken the smooth job at that point?
I don't think so. No, to your point, I don't think the chain of events had started occurring, but there was a lot of rumblings about Arkansas in general and if he was tight with the Tyson guy. Right, and again, maybe it wasn't even the Arkansas job. Maybe in his mind, he's like, USC's still open. There are NBA guys that still contact me. This Arkansas thing could happen. Like maybe he's got three or four jobs that he's kind of saying, whichever one opens for me, I'm going to seriously consider. I'd just like to know how much that was on his mind 2 weeks ago when they initially announced that he was coming back to Kentucky and when he and Mitch Barnhart made that video, because it is awkward to look back at now and think about what was going through their heads.
But at that point, he had him over a barrel with the buyout, right? And again, it's we still don't know at this moment if Mitch Barnhart did have the funding to get it done. I mean, that was the reporting. Some of the reporting was that he did. But again, I don't know if he did. And even if he did, again, he wasn't willing to pull the trigger on it at that point either.
Yeah, I think having the funding, absolutely. Knowing what we know about the way the buyout worked, they absolutely could have afforded it, because if they couldn't afford it, then they can't afford to pay a new head coach. I mean, going to be the equivalent of having to pay John Calipari's salary for the next however many years and pay another head coach. So they had the money, but the bigger question was, did they feel good about paying all that money to buy him out? And clearly the answer was no at that time, which still shocks me because I said at the time, I don't see how you bring him back.
We both I said it's an untenable situation. Remember I said, and I mean this sincerely, the first time they fell behind 10-4 in Rupp Arena would have been the most uncomfortable moment in the history of that program.
Totally. And that's why, and especially now seeing the way all this played out and how bad the relationship was between Cal and Mitch Barnhart and whoever else is there in charge at Kentucky, there's no way this would have worked for another year. They clearly have zero relationship whatsoever based on what we saw play out over the last 48 hours. Cal has zero respect for these people. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done what you did the last 2 days.
Agreed. Yeah.
The other point or piece of reporting that I thought was really interesting, Skinny, was Matt Norlander's report that Cal privately expressed serious interest in the Ohio State job back in February. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it shows that maybe he was looking for a get-out plan just in case. I mean, if things had gone well in March, I don't think that would have – listen, if things had gone well in March and this team had gone to the Final Four, he'd still be Kentucky's coach, and even the detractors would go, okay, I'm back on board. I can see him looking for a get-out-of-jail potentiality to it, but I don't know how serious it was, and obviously the timing of it never was going to work either, the way it worked out for Ohio State.
I guess the bigger question that I'm more interested in that I keep hearing from UK fans is how damning is that, in your opinion, that he may have been checked out the final month of the season if he was really considering taking another job?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little disturbing. I don't think him being checked out cost Kentucky the Oakland game. I think there's other things that cost. I mean, the season-long issues and the season-long promises to players of clutch relationships that started ahead of the two best players he had on his roster or two of his three best players. I think that was more damning. I don't think it was a matter of checking out. I think that was just a matter of his complete stubbornness, which really earmarked the last handful of years of his career.
All right, so the next big question becomes – who should Kentucky go after, Skinny? We've heard all the names. Obviously, there's a bunch of people who have already been thrown out there, and some of them have denied it. But who do you think is a realistic name that they should
target? Well, I will say this. I thought Matt Jones of Kentucky Sports Radio put it pretty well yesterday. He did an extra show, I think, on WLAP. I listened to it a little bit while I was driving around. If Scott Drew is your worse-off plan, if you will, or worse-off guy, if that's like the worst case scenario that you get Scott Drew, you're going to get a good basketball coach. I mean, if that's the worst case scenario, you're getting a qualified good basketball coach.
Totally agree with that. I don't know if I believe that is the worst case scenario for Kentucky. I tend to think it gets done before you get to the secondary names and the names that people are less enthused about. I think
Mark Pope's.
Yeah. I think it will be one of the more enticing names on here, one of the bigger splash hires. The Scott Drew thing has just been continuously mentioned for the last 5 or so years. I mean, really ever since COVID, I think, when he and Mitch Barnhart must have hit it off in the COVID bubble, it sounds like, from Pete Thamel's reporting, and they have some, I guess, mutual interest, including their religion or whatever. But ever since then, it has been talked about year after year that Mitch Barnhart really likes Scott Drew, and that if Cal ever left, that would be the guy that he'd look to. And so until Scott Drew turns this job down, I'm going to continue to believe that Scott Drew is the odds-on favorite to win.
Agreed.
Now, I don't know if you saw, did you see Billy Donovan's comments after the Chicago Bulls game Tuesday night?
I did.
That was shocking to me. I mean, he almost sounded like he was campaigning to get the job. Did he not?
Yeah, the only problem with Billy is this, and I love him. When I covered Kentucky in the late 1990s into the early 2000s, that was kind of the budding Florida-Kentucky rivalry, and Billy had gone to a championship game, was building up a roster. When I stopped covering him, I think 2 years afterwards, the first of the two national championships, and just being on conference calls, you know, we used to have SEC media conference calls. I've always liked and enjoyed Billy, and I think Billy's a great, great coach. I said this to a friend yesterday. The fear for me with Billy would be this. He's so far removed from the college game, and the game that he played is no longer the game that's being played today in recruiting. Can he get the portal right? I guess he can, but I don't know if I'm going to roll the dice on that. I like everything about Billy. He's great with media. I think he's a great coach. I think he's a roster builder. There's everything to like about Billy Donovan, right? But this far removed in this landscape, I just don't know if it's the right guy.
He has a ton of cachet, obviously, and especially in the college basketball world. But I guess my concern would be, does the cachet play with kids who are 18 years old right now? Do they like really remember who Billy Donovan is? I guess their parents probably do. And maybe that's sort of the idea as the parent, you know, that's why Georgetown was still popular for the last decade to a lot of parents, because they were really good in the 80s when those parents were growing up.
Yeah. And I don't think it hurts from a cachet perspective, being an NBA coach for as long as he's been an NBA coach too. You can always say, hey, I know what it takes to get to the league. I coached in the league, guys.
It does. But to your point about recruiting, one, it has completely changed. When you talk about the NIL and the transfer portal, it is so far a different ballgame than the one he left. Not to mention, the one he left, the AAU ties, all that stuff are pretty much gone. It's not the same AAU coaches and agents and all the runners and stuff that they were dealing with back. I mean, all those people went to jail and got outed by the FBI. So we've got a whole new crop of characters running the AAU underbelly of the world. And also, Skinny, the game has changed. Now, I know the NBA game has changed too. They play a different style in the NBA. Sure. Everyone's shooting more threes and playing smaller lineups. So he's probably fine with that, the X's and O's and how to play a smaller lineup and everything. But it has just changed a lot since he was dominating the college basketball world at Florida. So honestly, he'd be down my list out of their top candidates. He would probably be the last out of the top candidates I've heard of. Hurley, Drew, I'm not who else has been there at the top names.
Nate Oates. I mean,
yeah, Nate Oates would be another one I'd have above him, but that's not going to happen. He's already taken himself out of that job, it seems like. So yeah, those names are really the top ones. And I think Scott Drew is the most likely out of those.
I do too. Back to Billy, I will say though, let's not forget he was on the forefront of teams that began shooting threes at a high volume when he played at Providence. So he knows all about that part of the game. But to the point, the thing I said to my friend yesterday when I said that about Billy being too far removed for him to maybe work, he said, well, you hire a GM, and you know a lot of schools are starting to do that, right, to help navigate the NIL stuff. And maybe if that's the case, maybe that is the guy. But again, I'm with you. I think he's farther down my list, and that would have been blasphemy for me to say a decade ago when he was still coaching college. He would have been at the top of my list with a red circle around it 20,000 times.
Well, especially for Kentucky. They tried to get him twice. Right, they tried to get him when Billy G was hired, and then they tried to get him when Cal was hired, and both times he turned them down. So, I mean, in a way, it almost feels like UK fans would be chasing the glory day, you know, chasing what they wanted 10 years ago and didn't get, or 15 years ago. I don't know that I'd be as excited about him this time. Now, don't get me wrong. It's still a splash hire. It's a huge name. It's one of the best college basketball coaches maybe we've ever seen. And I think it's still a great hire, and he has a high chance of being successful there. But it wouldn't be the most exciting hire, in my opinion. Hurley is the obvious one that would be the best. I just don't think there's any chance that happens.
I don't either. And here's why I like Scott Drew over Nate Oates. And you made your point well known about Nate Oates last week, and it's a great point. And he's done great things at Alabama. I mean, Scott Drew resurrected Baylor from literally the ashes to a consistent national prominent program. Have there been a bump in the road here and there? Yeah, it's Baylor, folks. I mean, it's not blue blood. It's Baylor. But for the most part, they have consistently, once he got it rolling, been an NCAA tournament team, had some runs, done some really good things. They've had a couple of flameouts. I'll grant you all that stuff. But he's built the program. And Nate Oates at the moment is a little flavory of the month. And I know he's done things like the last three or four years. It hasn't been a 1 year window. He did great things at Buffalo. Again, I'm not pissing on Nate Oates. Trust me, I'm not. I just think because the other part to Baylor was, who was Baylor before they had their flame? They were a nothing program then. And he's built this into a consistent powerhouse isn't the right word, but a consistent top 25 program that's always in the mix, always in the hunt.
A true contender that's won a national title.
And I think there's something to be said for that. That I know it's not as sexy. Nate Oates is sexy because of the way he plays, right? They run up and down. They shoot threes. They dunk. Don't have any – again, I'm not trying to rain on this Nate Oates thing. And, again, he's already said he doesn't want it. That's a lot of sometimes just mouth talk at the moment. But I don't think Scott Drew is an awful fallback plan, if it is a fallback plan. And it might just be his number one choice, period.
Yeah, I'll be real. I think with the way this has been reported so far, people have gotten way out over their skis on the reporting of this, saying like this guy's been interviewed or this guy's a candidate and he's turned it down. So a lot of those guys we weren't even to that part of the program yet when these guys were allegedly turning down the jobs and stuff. So I think Scott Drew is a more priority candidate than people are letting on. I don't think he's the fallback plan based on everything that I know and have heard. And I think there's a decent chance he'll end up being the coach. Now, if he's not, then it gets more interesting because some of those other names feel like I don't think you're getting Hurley and I don't think you're getting Oates based on what we've seen so far. Agreed. So if you don't get Donovan and you don't get Drew, then things become more interesting. And we do probably need to start talking about the Bruce Pearls and the Sean Millers and the Shaka Smart.
Well, it's funny you brought that part up. So Sean Miller's name has been in that next tier of guys. A, how interested would he be in it? And B, how do you think he would do with it?
So first of all, I would say it's Kentucky. All these people are like, oh, is it a fit? Do they like it? Are they interested? It's Kentucky. Every single coach that's ever coached in the history of college basketball is going to be interested if Kentucky calls them. I'm not saying they'll take the job. I'm not saying it's definitely for them, but they're going to listen. They're almost certainly going to take the interview. You'd be crazy not to. It is the pinnacle of college basketball, regardless of their lack of success over the last decade plus. So I think he would listen. I think it would be hard to turn Kentucky down if you really got a full-blown offer from Kentucky while you're currently the head coach at Xavier. How do I think he'd do? I actually think he'd do pretty well with that now. Like, let's remember, the man spent a lot of time at Arizona.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty, like, fish tank type situation there. Like, a lot of people are focused on the Arizona basketball program and have way too high of expectations for it.
Rick, we can label what blue bloods are, right? I mean, UConn's entering the conversation, but whatever tier is right below blue blood, Arizona's program's in that tier.
Well, and they're almost worse than that, Skinny. They're kind of like Indiana, where they kind of were a blue blood and have now fallen out of that. So what you get with that is fans who are into it like a blue blood and criticize like you're a blue blood and put the pressure on you like you're a blue blood, but you ain't a blue blood and you're not competing with resources like a blue blood and you're not recruiting like a blue blood. So I think he can handle the pressure. I think he's already been in that situation enough. Arizona is not Kentucky. Don't get me wrong, but it's a pretty high pressure job.
No doubt.
And he did that for a long time and he was obviously successful. I know at Kentucky it's Final Fours. It's not Elite Eights. Right. So he would have, That's the big mark against him is he has not been to the Final Four yet. But
hey, right now, you know what the expectation is? Get me to a second weekend.
Well, that's a huge part of it. And then Skinny, also, if you start looking at Sweet 16s out of current NCAA active college coaches, Tom Izzo has the most at 15. Bill Self has the next most at 14. Rick Pitino, 13. John Calipari, 12. You know who's next in that list?
I'm guessing it's Sean Miller. I would have never.
Sean Miller with 8. Yeah. Yeah. And the active list of Sweet 16s. So if you're going to start talking about, like, the thing people will use against Sean Miller is his lack of NCAA tournament success because he doesn't have the Final Four. But if we're really talking about, like, proven success getting to the second weekend, Sean Miller is probably as good as you can get in terms of the names that are being mentioned right now for this job. So I say all that to, let me be very clear. I would have been much more worried about the Ohio State job as a Xavier fan.
Right.
I do not think Sean Miller will end up being the next head coach at Kentucky.
And I don't mean this disparagingly. I mean, if you're putting a list, literally listing guys, he's probably barely hanging into the top 10 or the bottom part of the top 10. And that's a lot of red lines you got to go through before you get to that guy.
And that's exactly right. And Skinny, that's why if you go to musketeerreport.com over the last 5 days, there's been no mention of Sean Miller and the UK job. I have not been reporting on this as if it's something that's about to happen, because quite honestly, I don't think he's really in the conversation yet. Now, we may get to that point, and if so, it will get interesting because it's Kentucky.
Well, and here's the thing. If we get to that point, is that a damning mark on Kentucky? Is that just, hey, I can win at UConn and win big because I've proven it? Hey, I can win at Alabama and win at a really high level in today's environment and still make enough money without having the same level of pressure on me? Is this more of a mark on that, or is it just the landscape of guys being happy where they're at and knowing they can do things where they're at, especially with NIL?
It kind of seems like there may be now, again, I think one of the top candidates will take this job. So this conversation is probably pointless, but
yes,
if we do get to the point you're talking about and it's multiple people have turned it down and we're talking about secondary options, similar to the way the UCLA situation happened when Mick Cronin ended up being the head coach and they had cycled through like 5 or 6 or 7 names publicly before they got to him. If it happens like that, then I don't know if it is somewhat damning on the Kentucky job, but I think it's more of a shift that we've seen across the country and the way coaches view these jobs and these high pressure jobs, that maybe the absolute most money and the absolute best resources aren't necessarily the best situation for you anymore because of the pressure that comes with it.
And again, Danny Hurley's proving that you're borderline. I mean, winning 2 championships, period, is ridiculous. Back-to-back is even more ridiculous. And probably the capability to put together a roster to go for 3 in a row isn't far-fetched. And he's doing it at UConn.
Do you think, had they lost the championship game, that there's a better chance that he would take the Kentucky job?
I don't. There's a part of me that says him winning it would probably lend him to say, listen, could I go for three in a row and make this epic? Sure. But hey, I've done all I can do at UConn. See ya. I think his DNA is A, he's a Northeast guy.
Yeah.
B, he's at a program that pays him enough money. He knows exactly what he's doing. You want to talk about the last 25 years? I'll put UConn in the last 25 years as a blue blood program, period. End of story.
The conversation is over on that.
Yeah. And here's the other part. And this is where you can define the Kentucky job for people worrying about Cal leaving and, oh my God, what this is. Maybe the short term is a bad bump for whatever reason, for recruiting, whatever. But listen, five different coaches have won national championships at Kentucky. Three different coaches have won it at UConn. I mean, that tells me that that's a program that can sustain success. And that's why, again, I don't worry about this hire. And I think you and I talked about this. I think the Pat Kelsey hiring at Louisville is fascinating to see if that's a route ADs start to go of, hey, I'm not worried about big name guy. I'm worried about a competent coach, and I'm going to take our boosters. Let's pump money into NIL and win that way. That's probably not the case at Kentucky. You still got to win the press conference. You got to win the name battle. I get all that. But if Pat Kelsey succeeds at a high level at Louisville, the way they've done this, I think it's fascinating to watch what other ADs do moving forward.
Yeah, but doesn't everybody win the press conference now? Like, I mean, honestly, anything that anyone does, as long as you put out a social media video of some sort that shows that you have any ounce of charisma and personality, your fans will love you. They'll be on for the whole first several months before you actually play a game. The fan base will think you're the best thing that's ever invented, no matter who you are, pretty much. So, like, I think the winning the press conference thing has kind of been overblown at this point. I would just strictly be worried about, can the guy do the job, and does it make sense financially at this point?
Agreed. Could Josh Schertz coach Kentucky? I don't know. Maybe.
Like, could he do it? Yes. But now I'm kind of backtracking to what I just said. To your first point, I do think there is like something about the Kentucky job where you need a little bit of celebrity and pop to you.
That's my point. That's my point.
And that's kind of the interesting thing about Scott Drew. That's the only real knock against Scott Drew is he's not the big personality, the celebrity. He's kind of dry, seems like just kind of a nice, good person. I think that plays better right now with Kentucky because they're coming off of Cal. So you want the opposite of Cal now.
Well, it's the old in baseball. You want a player's manager until the players run the asylum. Then you need the disciplinarian. Then the disciplinarian runs amok. And we need a player's manager. I get it. It's the different. It is. It's truly the different voice, different way. Again, another friend of mine said, I just want a guy to come in and coach basketball. I don't need all the BS. Yep. I don't need the hucksterism. I just need a guy to go coach basketball and coach it well.
I think that is the wavelength that a lot of UK fans are on right now. And that's why I think Scott Drew would really be a home run hire in this cycle. Had you done that 15 years ago, coming off of Billy Clyde Gillespie, gotten a guy like Scott Drew? And obviously Scott Drew wasn't the same guy at that point, but I mean, a coach like him that doesn't have that cool factor that Cal had, I don't think it plays nearly as well.
I will say this. Mitch Barnhart needed to make that as big of a home run as he could possibly make after the Billy Clyde disaster.
And he nailed it. Cal was the perfect guy at that time for Kentucky. It was exactly what the program and fan base needed to keep Kentucky in the position it's in. Because Cal said during that video, and I agree with him, he said, if you ask any coach that's done this or is in college basketball, Kentucky is the bluest of the blue bloods. And I do think that's the way it's viewed. I mean, there are only four that are undoubted, never been questioned blue bloods. It's Kentucky, Carolina, Kansas, and Duke. And we can talk about the other ones that have been in now.
UCLA's got to be. I mean, you win as many championships as they've won. They're still a blue blood program.
I disagree with that. See, I think they're debatable. I think they've been just for so long that it's like, and no one really cares about basketball out there. I do not consider them
fair.
A blue blood.
Yeah, that part of it's fair.
Yeah, there are four programs that have never wavered from that blue blood status, at least as long as I've ever been conscious about college basketball. And it's those four. And out of those four, despite their lack of recent success, I would still say Kentucky carries the most weight in the sport out of all of them.
Yeah, probably.
So we mentioned UConn. They did win the national championship on Monday night.
Was it a game Monday?
A blowout win. They ran Purdue off the court in the second half. Skinny, looking back at the tournament now, and I will agree with some of the people early on who were kind of complaining about it, saying it wasn't a good tournament. I will now agree and say it felt like that tournament was about as chalky or as scripted as any tournament we've ever watched. I don't know that it's a bad thing. I just think it's a year where we had one team who was so clearly the best and another team that was so clearly the second best. And Even when they matched up in the finals, the second best wasn't good enough to compete with the best.
Yeah, no, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the that 96 Kentucky team where it was almost a four, even though they lost in the SEC tournament, you know, once they got rolling in the tournament, they were clearly the best. It's probably back in the days that people felt about UCLA's dynasty that, you know, the first one I can remember watching as a kid was the 1971 final, and they played Villanova, and the whole tournament was a foregone conclusion. And as the years went by until their reign ended, it was a foregone conclusion. So, yeah, and I'm not disappointed by it because I don't mind the best team winning. There's nothing wrong with that, especially when they went out and played the way they did. I enjoy watching them play. I mean, as a coach, I love everything they do on both ends of the floor. It's hard to find fault other than those who think Danny Hurley's a nut, and I think he's a nut, but I like him as a nut. I mean, they're well coached. They play well together. They have some NBA guys, but I hate to say it. I enjoyed watching them play all year.
I love watching that team play, and watching their dominance was fun too. And it's cool that it's like there's a storyline with it. We didn't just watch blowouts through the tournament. We watched back-to-back championships. We watched a team that dominated in a way that we really haven't seen in modern basketball in the college level. So it was really, really fun to watch them. But I will agree with the fans who like the chaos, like the upsets. You didn't get a lot of craziness in this tournament.
Well, funny thing, we didn't have a lot of it, and I was kind of rang through when I was watching One Shiny Moment. We didn't have a lot of last-second buzzer beaters either, hardly any.
And that's what a lot of people were complaining about that early, that there weren't the upsets and the buzzer beaters. And the kind of refrain was, okay, but that'll set up for a lot of great games later in the tournament. And we got some good matchups, but not a lot of them became crazy games. It's just like right. The better team ended up winning in most of those games, it seemed like, and kind of did so handily. Any other thoughts about the tournament or UConn's run as a whole?
No, it didn't disappoint me. It really didn't. I know everybody likes buzzer beaters. I know we like Cinderellas to go far. I thought we had one Cinderella we all cling to, and that was NC State. And it was a fun run to watch what they did and all that. And it did take away from the chalkiness a bit. But again, I thought the tournament was good. Again, I don't have a hard time being bothered by the best team winning it.
We did. We had a few Ask Any Anything questions that came in about. Well, asking anything questions, but they ended up being about kind of college basketball and what we're talking about now. So I'll ask them to you. And the first was, do you think Zach Edey will be a good NBA player, Skinny?
I do not, but I don't think he'll be a bust that some think. I don't know who he guards and how he guards them. But I also will tell you, I think he's a very skilled post guy offensively that teams don't play through them. But if you have a guy like that, I think you'll have something for him that whatever, you know, if he's in that second rotation group, we play through Zach in the second rotation. We go back to playing open post when he's not in there. So I do think there's a role for Zach Edey in the NBA. Do I think he's going to be an all-star? No, but do I think he's going to be a 10 to 12 year veteran? I think he can be that guy. I really believe that.
I agree. I think there's a role for him on teams. Now, I don't know that he's going to play a ton of minutes in the playoffs when it's on the line, all that, but throughout the regular season, I can see him being a bit of a minutes eater in the post that can give you some production.
The thing is, Rick, I mean, obviously when you have whatever second unit is in there, you need a couple of scorers, and maybe you don't have them at your other positions, but you have one at the post, and that you go, hey, we're going to run the offense through you for the first 4 minutes of the second quarter while my starters get rest. And you're the main focal point for those 4 minutes. And I think you can get away with him for 4 minutes on the defensive end and maybe longer than that, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, maybe he is the scorer in the second unit.
You also have to guard this guy, and he's impossible to guard. This isn't Sean Bradley. This isn't Manute Bol. He's not a sideshow. He is like really skilled and coordinated down low.
And Rick, when this was so many teams having so many shooters, can you imagine just surrounding him with snipers?
I mean, you cannot double down in the NBA Correct. Like you do in college. Correct. And trying to guard that guy without a double team, I really don't know how you do it without fouling. So I think there is a real role for him in the NBA. I don't know exactly how many minutes and exactly how much production there is, but I'd be shocked if he doesn't carve out some type of niche on a roster.
I agree with you. I don't think he'll be a star by any stretch because, again, I don't know how he's going to guard and how they're going to make that work.
But so many teams just play drop coverage now that they kind of let these guys just hang out underneath the free throw line.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is I don't know if you remember one of the plays. I think it was the Tennessee game. He got a defensive rebound, outletted it. The fast break didn't develop the way I think Purdue was thinking it would on the break, but they still attacked the basket. It was a miss. He rim ran from behind everybody. And, I mean, when you saw it, the replay, like, damn, he's way more athletic than I really thought he was, and he tip dunked it. And I thought, okay, I know I never thought of him as a plotter, but just watching that sequence, I went, that was pretty damn athletic.
The athleticism and the body control are so underrated. When everyone just says he's just big, I'm like, how many times do we have to see 7 foot plus guys who are terrible in terms of coordination, athleticism, body control? And then you see a guy like this and not realize it's extremely different. Like, we don't get a lot of Zach Edey's for a reason, because having that massive body and being able to control it like he does is almost impossible. So I'm surprised so many people think he can't play. I understand it's not the most fun style of basketball to watch, but I think he's really good and really a generational talent.
Yep, I agree.
The other question that we got from a few different people actually was, will Skinny be back as a UK fan? Can Big Blue Nation count you back in as a basketball supporter of the Wildcats with the new coach now that John Calipari is gone?
Yeah, and I think I'm trying to think if there's anyone that they would hire where I would say no to that. Absolutely. Yeah, I actually thought about that yesterday. I thought it'll actually be refreshing for me to get to march and root, as opposed to I'm watching the Oakland game literally.
Rooting for Jack Golke to hit another three.
I wasn't hoping for that because I picked Kentucky to go to the Final Four in a bracket. I had him in a couple of pools. And I did that more with my head. I thought I was doing that with my head the way the draw was, so that was not with my heart at all. Because my heart would have been rooting for Oakland more than Kentucky. But
I don't know, Skinny. You called me in the second half of that game. It sounded an awful lot like you were rooting for Jack Golke.
Well, I was rooting for him just because I love watching performances like that. It was fun to watch. But yes, I will be back in for sure.
All right. That's a good way to end that segment then. A lot of people were worried about whether or not they could get some UK fan takes from you again. They want you back on their side, Skinny. They're tired of you hating on their team.
I want to be back. I didn't want to be the first one to call out Cal for what he really is, as an absolute huckster.
But you were right all along, as it turns out.
I hate to be.
All right. So just to wrap up this segment one more time, final take. Who do you think is going to be the head coach?
I'm with Scott Drew. I'm with Scott Drew, too. Again, it's not the safe pick. To me, I think it's the right pick. Listen, we all would agree. If Danny Hurley would come back up the Brinks truck and let's do this thing, because he's got the big personality. He's been a program builder. You know, it's funny, people, the first few years they would have probably run him out of town. The things he did at UConn, dude, he was building a roster at a different time, building a roster. You weren't doing it through
the American
at that point. In the American, thank you. Yes, that too. Dude did it. Listen, he'd be the home run of home run hires. I think he'd be as big a home run hire, if not a bigger home run hire, than when UK hired Cal. I mean, he has done more than what Cal did.
As soon as Dan Hurley got to the Big East, everything changed for UConn. So it was a clear difference, him recruiting to the Big East versus him recruiting to the American Athletic Conference.
And think about, Jim Calhoun, when he had his success, they were in the Big East.
To me, I would go as far as to say Dan Hurley is the only candidate, in my opinion, that's worth the big-time dollars that they're talking about throwing around. If you're going to pay over $6 or $7 million a year for a coach, Dan Hurley's the only guy that I would be willing to do that for, in my opinion, that they're currently after.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And again, I know people are going to look at some of the Scott Drew seasons and go, oh boy, what if we go through one of these at Kentucky? Again, he's doing it at Baylor, people. Remind yourself of that. And he won a national championship at Baylor, people. Remind yourself of that. And he won a national championship more recently than Cal did. Remind yourself of that.
And also, by the way, he's one of those guys that got screwed by the COVID year. He had a great team the COVID year.
And in defense, so did Cal. And obviously, so did the University of Dayton.
But it's funny because people, UK fans will always bring that up as a defense for UK and Cal. And it's like, well, I mean, Scott Drew would be right in that same boat in that case. So, there we go. We both think Scott Drew will be the next Kentucky coach if we had to guess. And the refrain from Kentucky fans is going to be exactly what you brought up, that you said one of your buddies had told you, Skinny. Kentucky fans are going to be saying, I'm glad to finally just have a guy who's focused on basketball. We don't need Drake at our practice. We don't need to be talking about the NBA or the draft coming up. We just want to focus on UK basketball. That's what Scott Drew will be for them.
And to put a bow on that, I do think Cal's constant, I'm doing this for the players in the NBA, really did grow old. I mean, if you're coaching at Kentucky fans are expecting you to make that about Kentucky, not about helping. And listen, kudos to him for helping those kids and all those things. And listen, he should be remembered for the philanthropic stuff he did at Kentucky. Again, I'm not a fan of Cal as a coach or Cal the huckster. There's a lot of things he did good, and I understand why he did that initially, which was to consistently say, hey, I'm getting guys ready for the NBA. Keep coming to me. Smart move. But after a while, when you're not winning with that, it just gets old.
Well, fans didn't like it that much when they were winning.
Right.
Once he stopped winning with it, it was immediately out the window and old, and it really became a problem with the fan base.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's switch gears here. Talk a little Reds baseball to wrap up the show, probably. The Reds are 6-5 as we record this on Wednesday. They won their first two series against the Nationals and Phillies, but then lost the next one to the Mets. They've split the first two against the Brewers in this next series that they're in the midst of right now. Skinny, the team announced Monday that right-handed reliever TJ Antone will be shut down for the season after he had a tendon tear completely off the bone and a partially torn ligament in his elbow. The injury status of this team just continues to be completely a wreck.
His is the saddest of all because of the comeback, just the sheer joy he had when he was told he was made the team, because it kind of capped that comeback from surgery. And then, boy, watching that in real time on Sunday when it happened, I'm like, oh, my God, he's done. That's it. There's no way. And I think for him now, whatever surgery you have is to give you quality of life, and I don't even think I would even attempt to return. If he does and he somehow makes it back in a year or two, what a story that would be. Good for him. But at this point, I think I just want to get my quality of life.
Yeah, you just feel terrible for a guy like this.
Yep.
Beyond the baseball part of it. You know, I mean, this just really changes everything you've been planning and thinking about and the direction of your life and the course that everything's going to go. It really sucks for a guy like this.
And not to be callous and cold, I mean, there's a chance, you know, Ian Jabeau now is on the final stage of his rehab assignment. I mean, he could have been the odd man out at that point too, which again, would have kind of sucked, but I guess he still would be throwing a baseball and doing what he wants to do. But just to watch that happen, if that's the end of your career, to watch your elbow pop out, oh, good Lord.
Skinny, I hate to say it, but it almost would have been better for him to kind of gone out, you know, been forced out. Like,
yeah,
you're not good enough anymore. We need, you know, okay, it's my time. I'm not going to cut it. But to have it taken away from you through injury when you think you still have a chance, that's got to be tough for him to live with. And it stinks to see. And this team, Skinny, I mean, how many injuries are – I know this isn't the same as Matt McClain or TJ Friedl, but
– The India one getting hit on the hand, I don't know if you saw the at-bat after that. He popped out to, like, short left field, and it looked like he really winced in pain. Now, he did come back. Obviously, he played Tuesday night's game, started to hit leadoff and played second base. So, but then the freak thing that happened to him on Monday, getting hit in batting practice. Holy cow.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we're talking about, like, people were mad when Jamer Candelario was signed. And now look at who they're starting in the infield.
You're right. I will say I am mad that Jamer Candelario is still batting cleanup. I have a hard time understanding that. Jamer Candelario on a good team bats seventh to begin with, let alone cleanup from the beginning of the season. And sometimes managers perplex me. I don't get – he was never a cleanup hitter on any good team. Why is he batting cleanup for you? Why is he batting cleanup coming off a crappy spring, a crappy last – go back and look at his last month last year, and now he's off to a crappy start. Listen, he's got to play. And I think he should play, but he sure as hell doesn't need to be batting cleanup still.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I saw that stat that I think Lance had tweeted out that at least that's where I saw it, that had the last month of last season, the spring training stats, and the first month or the first however many games of this season. And he's hitting like 140 through that stretch, Skinny. And it's not like nothing.
Like 140 at bats.
Right. And I know spring training doesn't mean a whole lot, but at what point do you start to become concerned that this guy just can't really cut it?
Well, again, this is probably not an ascending talent either. This is a guy whose career is probably at the plateau, and you hope it hasn't already plateaued and now you're on the other side of it. I mean, it's funny. If you ever – one of the things in baseball reference is to watch guys who are good, maybe even stars, watch their ascension through their 20s and maybe early 30s, and then you can see the plateau, and then it starts to drop for some guys. That plateau starts a little bit earlier. Guys who aren't maybe superstars, which he's not. You know, I just hope he's in on the other side of the plateau.
Yeah, well, I mean, but again, like you said, they have to play him because everybody's hurt right now. They don't.
And that's fine. You can bat him eighth. The world will survive him batting eighth.
Batting eighth. They should absolutely move him down to the lineup. But I mean, I'm to the point where it's like you almost want to say, "Why is this guy still playing?" But somehow on this roster with all the extra infielders that they had way too many of, they're out of infielders.
Well, I will say this. When Friedl comes back, you will have to start making some decisions on outfielders. Certainly one of them can DH. But at that point, if he's not hitting, do you consider moving Spencer Steer back to third base? It probably doesn't help your defense any, but it may be by default if the guy's not hitting.
Yeah, well, and I think that is the bigger concern right now is how do you make sure you get the offense on track and moving, and you kind of let the defense go as it will from there. On Wednesday, Charlie Goldsmith tweeted that David Bell said TJ Friedl has a check-in MRI scheduled for this week, and that it's also realistic that Matt McClain could return in August. Any thoughts on those two bits of news?
The Friedel one, certainly we knew he was coming back sooner than McClain by a long shot. I was hoping first month he'd be back at some point in May, and you know, you're at least at the very least spinning your tires as opposed to going backwards. And I think they're kind of at that point. You know, they still have a chance to win two more games with Milwaukee, and suddenly 6-5 becomes 8-5, and that's all well and good. But yeah, I think that would really set your lineup much better. I mean, India could hit second at that point. You know, you can then get Spencer Steer instead of hitting second on some days. He's a middle of the line. I think he's a clear middle of the lineup guy. It'll help your lineup immensely getting TJ Friedel back. It would help immensely getting both of those guys back. But getting Friedel back sooner rather than later gives you now, if India is going to continue to do this, and he's getting on base at about a 40% clip, which I don't think he's going to do that, but I think he's can get on base at a 375-ish clip. You get him and Friedel at the top of the lineup and Steer somewhere in the middle of that and get CES starting to hit. And I think he's coming around a little bit. He had a couple of hits on Tuesday night. I think he comes out of it way before Candelario does. I mean, look at Candelario's career. It's not like he's always been a 300 hitter, for goodness sakes. Right. He is what he is. And that's where it almost bemused me when I saw that opening day lineup with him hitting cleanup. And I started looking around going, all right, you're taking the pressure off of Ellie. I don't really understand Steer batting seventh, but I get it's a right-handed pitcher. So if that's how you're going to do this, okay, let's see how it does in the short. But Steer's done nothing but rake. Coming off of a year where he raked last year, he is clearly a 2-3-4-5 hitter against everybody.
Yeah, I don't understand why that's not obvious already. And I'm sure there's some weird analytical stat out there or some righty-lefty thing out there that suggests that this is the right way to do it. But that one just has never made sense.
It might be the right way to do it if your 3-4 hitters were hitting. CES isn't hitting at the moment, and neither's – I mean, you can't have your 3-4 hitters batting .163 each. Again, I think CES – this is going to be nothing but a blip on the radar for him. I think the kid's too talented to not hit. It's just the start for him. But again, Candelario's got a lot of the back of the baseball card. It's not stunning. It's solid. It screams certainly professional, major leaguer, but it doesn't scream middle of the lineup guy by any stretch of the imagination.
Matt McClain, I know people are excited, worried, anxious to get more news on him and see if he can somehow make it back this year. Obviously, David Bell lended some possibility there, saying that he could return in August. Skinny, the thing I think about when they start talking about him potentially returning in August, I think, okay, well, if this team is in it then, and there, you could always use a player of Matt McClain's caliber for the bench or for pinch hits or whatever, defensive replacement. So it's not that you won't take him and that he can't help. But if they are in position where they're potentially going to make the playoffs, Do you really have like the time to get a Matt McClain who hasn't played all year up to speed at that point? Or the guys that you've already been playing, have they done the job well enough that you're probably just going to keep them in place? I'm not sure exactly how that works out. I think it works back into the mix.
Because Santiago Espinal sucks at the plate. Trust me, it's fine. It'll be more than fine.
Well, Espinal is starting now, Skitty, because this team that has too many infielders doesn't need any more infielders. Can't stay healthy. So that's correct. The situation we're in. And quite honestly, if that's the case all year long, then you're not going to have to worry about the playoffs or anything like it.
The other point I will say is by the time he would return in August, you know who else you have back at that point? Noel De Marte's back at that point too.
How do you see that playing out then?
It may play itself out that he's replacing a 196 hitting Jamer Candelario at third base. I hope that's not the case. I hope that, again, as I always say, it sorts itself out.
It does. Unfortunately, it did way too quickly this year, and it sorted itself out and then some, and now you're looking for scraps again. So I guess that's it. Any other thoughts on the Reds here?
Well, I mean, it continues to be the topic of conversation, the daily frustration or joy of Ellie De La Cruz, right?
Yeah.
Folks, you're just going to have to live with it at the moment. I mean, the five errors suck. He's on pace, I believe, for 65 errors this season. Well, I don't think he's going to get that, but I do think he could get to 40. The defense has to get better. I'm with you. I'm with everybody on that. But right now, I'm just going to let him play through everything, swing through everything, because you get the magic moments of the inside the park home run and the home run off the batter's eye. He's on pace to score. What the hell? He's on pace to score 160 runs this year. You know, his OPS is over 900. For all the faults of him at the plate, his OPS is over 900. He's up there among the leaders in majors and runs scored. I mean, for all the things that we look at and pick at, he still does a lot of good things, and he's still 22 years old with less than 120 games under his belt.
Yeah, we talked about that so much last week, and people have been all over it after the inside the park home run and the blast to center field the other night. That I didn't want to get too much into that, but I do think with M. Skinny, there there's this tendency to be like wishing away the current state of Ellie De La Cruz. Like, it's, well, when he hits his stride and actually becomes, I'm not so sure that even if this is all he is, if it's not enough. Yeah, like, right. Maybe he's always going to make mistakes. And,
yeah, other than the – I mean, he's got to get better defensively. There's no question about that. That part, I mean, has to get better, or you need to fix a position for him. But right now, hey, listen, some great shortstops in baseball have come up making tons of errors, and then suddenly the guy's a gold glover 2 years later. I don't know if that's Ellie per se, but I'm going to have to live with the mistakes at the moment because I don't have an alternative, and B, let's let him play through this stuff.
Right. Let's just say, though, that he's going to continue to make the kind of silly errors that we talked about in last week's show. And those never necessarily get better, but it's not over the top egregious that they're happening all the time. And he continues to be kind of the type of hitter he is now, where he's not hitting as frequently as you'd like, but he still has so many, not so many, but has enough great moments and great nights that he can really carry you when he is at his best. I mean, is that enough? Is that, can you just kind of have a guy like that? Because I think you can. I think he's already better than a lot of starting players in the major leagues.
No question. No doubt about it. It's just, I think when you see the things that he can do, like he did with the home run off the batter's eye, like the inside the park home run, like the stealing of bases, that you expect something like that literally every single night, not just a base hit here and a base hit there. I mean, you know, don't forget he had the longest hitting streak in the majors. It wasn't much. It was a 13 or 14 gamer going back to last season. Snapped on Sunday. That's pretty consistent to me, to be honest with you. And again, but when you see the spectacular, you expect more. And maybe that's not fair.
I think that's right. But I just think I'm kind of getting to the point where it's like everyone keeps it feels like we're having this constant argument of like, is Ellie going to be good enough or not? Like, we're waiting to this point in the future where it's going to happen. And then we're just going to like decide one way or the other, either right. He was good or he was a bust. And I'm like, I kind of feel like we're already getting to the point where he's pretty clearly good enough to be like, he's a starting major league player right now, pretty obviously, with all the great things that he does, even if it's right. Not all the time.
A 900 OPS shortstop with arguably the best base stealing ability in baseball. That's not awful.
No, I mean, especially when you factor in like the ability to get an inside the park home run or hit the ball 450 feet for a home run in the same game. Like, that's just a crazy thing for pitchers to have to deal with. It puts pressure on them.
I told you in the preseason article, I preseason column I did with some predictions. I predicted Ellie's going to be the starting shortstop for the National League All-Star team. And I'm going to stick by that. It may be a starting shortstop with 24 errors at that point, but he does enough highlight real stuff. And I think the numbers are going to end up backing it up. And I think he's going to get the fan vote.
All right. Well, I've done this now for 2 straight weeks prior to the show, and I'm going to do it again. I'll tell you the same thing I've told you each of those shows. We've got some Bengals topics. They're not going anywhere. The season's not going anywhere. The draft will be coming up soon, so we'll have to start talking about that. But correct. We're going to punt on the Bengals again this week.
Well, we'll probably get a little bit. We'll probably be out of college basketball next week unless Kentucky makes a hire, which they probably will, so we'll discuss it. Yeah. But it may not be the hot topic that it is right now. So we'll get to some Bengals stuff next week. Next week will be about a week and a day from the draft. We'll get a bunch of Bengals into next week's podcast.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about them. We'll wrap it up with one more Ask Any Anything question that we didn't address earlier. And this kind of lends itself to the conversation from earlier as well. What's the most shocking Cincinnati sports headline that you can recall, Skinny? Greater Cincinnati area, I guess, because I imagine they're asking this coming off the Calipari news.
I would say, I guess, when Pete Rose was banned. I can't think of anything more. I mean, Huggins DUI was something, but it didn't shake up Xavier fans. That didn't shake up Kentucky fans.
I don't know
that they're going, ha, 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 ha. But I don't think it shook up. The Pete Rose one, that's probably the biggest one.
I don't know that it came as a shock, but Griffey coming home was a big story from my childhood that I remember being a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I don't know that it was shocking, but.
No, I can't remember where I was. I was covering the UK. I think I was covering a UK at Maryland game, and I was driving from the airport maybe to my hotel the day that came down. And I do remember going, oh, my God. Like, it took me by that. But Pete's news was – and I know Pete's was building, so it didn't come out of nowhere. I guess in theory, Griffey's was a shock because it did kind of come out of nowhere, right? Pre-internet age, sources leaking stuff. It was –
That's what I forgot about. There was no internet. That's why it was kind of shocking because
it was internet infancy, but it wasn't social media.
I remember there was like report. Cause if you remember, Pokey Reese at the time was untouchable when they were trying to get that deal done. Pokey Rees couldn't be touched. You couldn't have Pokey Rees for Ken Griffey Jr. Like, I think the Mariners basically wanted Pokey Rees straight up for Ken Griffey. Otherwise, you're like, no chance, no how. We'll give you everything we have except for Pokey Rees. And you see how that turned out. But that's right. I remember that there wasn't the social media update. So you were like, here's something on Monday. And then right. Like Thursday it happened.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. Yeah, that was crazy to live through that. Kind of forgot about the invention of social media and how much that changed the way we have news come out. Because this Cal thing, how did it come out for you? Did you hear Sunday night or did you wait till Monday morning?
So it's funny you say that. I fell asleep at about 10:30 Sunday night, had a busy weekend doing stuff, and there wasn't really anything on that I wanted to watch that night. I watched the women's game that day, watched baseball up until whatever. I just was watching some shows and kind of fell asleep on the couch. So I woke up at about 4:45 in the a.m. on my own, kind of clicked on a couple of things. I got a bunch of guys in a text chain going, Skinny, check in. I'm like, what is going on? I scrolled through and went, oh, wow. So then I went online. I'm like, and I'm on vacation. But I'm like, okay, we didn't have anybody overnight to put something up. So I'm like, I got to put a story up. So I put something up on our website about it. And so that's how I found out, with kind of looking at a text chain going, wait. So I do a radio hit in Lexington every Monday at 7:20 on 590 WVOK, for those that maybe are Lexington people. And so the host, when he asked me, he said, so we got a little bit to talk about today. I said, yeah, Jack, I kind of fell asleep last night early about 10:45. Did anything happen overnight? And he laughed. He goes, you do know. I said, I do know. But I literally did fall asleep at 10:45 and didn't know until about 4:45 this morning what had happened. So I actually, you know, Rick used to do this for a living. I pushed the story out, which people get push alerts. You know what I'm talking about. I pushed the story out. And I know it was some hours old, but I guarantee you there were some people who woke up to that push and went, what? I guarantee it.
The mobile notification on the phone told them. I mean, I think a lot of people had that happen to them where they were either alerted by a text that morning or a push alert or whatever. It was an all-time moment for college basketball fans Sunday night, because you know, I mentioned my buddy who had kind of told me a few things about what was going on. He actually tipped me off around like 8:30 p.m. I want to say, like, hey, there's some things coming out there. You're going to hear more about it. I just want to let you know it's real. And then he started sharing with me what I told you before. And it just from there, it just snowballed. Like the text messages kept coming. You all of a sudden started seeing the tweets go. And then people are like, John Rothstein's asleep. We thought he didn't sleep till May. He's missing this. Like just all the silliness that's going on when a story that big breaks after 10 p.m. is so great. Yes. Like that, it's just, it causes absolute chaos on social media. And it was a fun night.
No question. All right, Rick, I appreciate it. We'll be back next week. Back next week with probably a Kentucky coach hire. I can't imagine they're going to go a full week plus without getting this done. Some more Reds, and obviously the Bengals and the NFL draft are fast approaching. For Rick Roaring, I'm Richard Skinner. It's been the Skinny Podcast, the weekly Potpourri edition, presented by Blake, the Attorney Mason.